In today's episode, we speak to a man who suddenly found himself chief of staff in Theresa May's Brexit department. And, in opinion, Poppy Knorr on why the crisis for high street retailers is hitting women's jobs the hardest. We'll start after this.
The eyes to the right, 311. The nose to the left, 293.
In an unprecedented move yesterday, the government was found in contempt of Parliament. Now ministers have to publish the legal advice on the backstop, the most contentious part of the Brexit deal.
At the start of 5 days of debate, that will set the course our country takes for decades to come.
And Theresa May must battle against all odds to win support for the overall agreement.
No backstop means no deal. Yeah.
But how did we get here? Brexit tensions have been building up for months, not just in Parliament, but in the negotiating rooms of Brussels and Downing Street. In July, a former MP, Nick Dubois, was unexpectedly given behind-the-scenes access.
I was not going to be able to hide. Politicians, MPs, they can hide a bit, but actually you're on the front line here.
From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, getting a front row seat for the Brexit showdown.
I was in Spain just beginning a three-month holiday.
Tory politician Nick Dubois has had a lot of free time since he lost his seat in 2015.
And I've got a little home out in between Alicante and Valencia.
He's worked on a mayoral campaign, written a book, Confessions of a Recovering MP.
And I was sitting there in front of the pool, looking at this view of a mountain, my feet up on a deck chair.
And then he headed off to Spain, where he couldn't quite switch off.
I was reading on the phone, scrolling down. I saw the resignation of David Davis, and then I waited for the appointment.
Reading the Guardian Politics live blog.
I wouldn't quite go that far.
Davis was replaced as Brexit secretary by another Leave campaigner, Dominic Raab.
So I was catching up on the news, and I saw Dom got a job. So I just sent him a text a little later, and which, you know, former colleagues, it was great. I was pleased for him.
You had been MPs together.
Yeah, we came in 2010 together. And much to my surprise, because I never expected to hear back. I thought he'd be inundated. But half an hour later, I got a text coming back saying, are you free later to chat? And I thought, little part of me was thinking, I wonder where this is going.
And do you remember the conversation?
Oh, yeah, I remember the conversation very well. He got straight to it. He said, well, I hope you're interested, but I need a chief of staff. And it just came out like that. And I was absolutely knocked over. 48 hours later, I was on my way back to the UK. The amazing thing is, I'm going into this job. We are July the 19th. And I am, my first day is not even in Downing Street where the office is. It's actually on a train to Brussels and we're going out to meet Michel Barnier and the negotiators. And
that Your first day?
My first day. So I turned up at St Pancras and that's actually where I saw Dom for the first time and his officials as we boarded the train. It was
there
just bizarre.
Chief of staff.
Yeah.
On the train.
Yes.
Going to meet Michel Barnier.
But what was
what?
So... Yeah, I know. It was a pinch yourself moment.
So you get on the train with these officials. Take us through this day.
Well, as you know, going to Brussels is just over 2 hours on the train. And I did not have one single paper in advance because I was not an employee of government. I wasn't security checked. So I turned up literally clutching a coffee whilst everyone else came with full briefing papers. So essentially for that 2 hours, I was given papers to read just to get to grips. I did not have a speaking part, which I think would come as a great relief to just about everyone at this point.
But for you, you've not had any of these briefing papers before today. Have you just basically Googled it?
Well, I think it's fair to say that I was doing some open research before I got there because I was not able to do anything. Remember, I'd had this call about, let's say, 48, 72 hours beforehand.
Our challenge will be to find common ground between the fundamental principles that define the EU and the UK positions.
We walk into this room, quite a large room, but not a big council chamber, nothing like that. So we all filtered down the left-hand side as you came in, and Michel and his team were opposite us. And because it was our first meeting, they had the cameramen in and the shaking of hands, as you would expect. So this photo was taken, and I'm perched at the end in my rightful place, and I'm sort of leaning forward for the camera a bit. And as my wife remarked later, well, in fact, quite a few people remarked later, when the photo, I think, was published in a newspaper, they said, goodness, they said, looking down that table, you look like the only one who was happy to be there. And is that a real suntan? So, and then you sit around this table and, you know, it is a very professional atmosphere. I was hugely impressed at the substance of the conversations, the courtesy, the professionalism that both sides brought to the discussions.
And Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister, told us the coffee's terrible.
Oh, I did listen to that. And when he talked about the coffee, I roared with laughter because he's right. It is awful.
This was a critical time for Brexit. Theresa May had just published her plan, the so-called Chequers Agreement, and the result was cabinet resignations.
The Brexit Secretary David Davis resigns, saying he no longer believes in the government's EU strategy. He tells the Prime Minister her Brexit...
In came a new Brexit Secretary, Dominic Raab.
I'm looking forward to, with renewed energy, vigour and vim, heating up the negotiations and making
sure... And his
sure
Chief of Staff, Nick Dubois. Day one, you're already in the Brussels mill, and that carries on for the entire period. Back home, your new office is 9 Downing Street. So can you explain what the Department for Exiting the EU is for and what it does day to day?
It's basically, the department, when we were there, was essentially responsible for the negotiations, and actually the Prime Minister has always been the lead negotiator. And her deputy, first David Davis, then Dominic Raab, were heading up the department that headed up the negotiations. You then have them also doing preparedness. So you'll hear all about this talk about, are we ready for no deal? Well, their job is to coordinate the no deal preparedness, which depends on the cooperation and provision for no deal through all the departments that are affected. So they would be responsible for preparedness both once we've done a deal and preparing and planning for no deal.
And do you agree with some of your colleagues who would argue that all those civil servants are basically Remainers working against Brexit?
No, not at all. I imagine if you dug through some of my former speeches in the House of Commons, you might find I haven't been as kind or respectful of the civil service as I am now. But actually, they are often consummate professionals, and I got huge respect for them. But no, are they all plotting to remain? No, far from it. Do they respect the boundaries about being political and being civil service? Absolutely.
So you've ended up in a senior role in this unbelievably important government department. What does a chief of staff actually do?
Well, essentially, that is a role where you are his senior political advisor. You're actually a political appointment. You're not a civil servant, but you're also something of an enforcer. Your job is to make sure that things he's requesting are actually getting done. And when they are done, they're done. First of all, they have a political eye over them, a political judgment made about them, but that they are also done as to his requirements and his needs. And it's all about helping the Secretary of State do his job better.
Boris Johnson and David Davis had resigned in protest at Theresa May's deal. But you and Dominic Raab, also Brexiteers, came into government believing that you could still get your vision for Brexit. When was the moment you realised that wasn't going to happen?
I don't think you ever think ahead, oh, this is the moment at all. I was working for a Secretary of State that I was absolutely committed to. But obviously, you know, he's on record talking about the indeterminate nature of the backstop, which effectively leaves you to all intents and purposes, without a get-out clause from what is effectively a hybrid customs union and single market. That's something that I would not want to stand for. And I.
But you negotiated it.
No, it's not that straightforward. The point is, you would have had the discussions taking place. You would have tried to have influenced those discussions. But when it gets to the point that a cabinet approves something that you cannot, in all good conscience, support. Obviously, that's when Dominic took the decision he did.
The Brexit Secretary, Dominic Raab, has resigned. This is seismic news for Theresa May as she prepares...
But I don't quite understand this, because we all remember that cabinet meeting. It was 5 hours long, the Prime Minister trying to persuade everyone to back her deal, press conference that was being pushed back and back.
The cabinet has just had a long, detailed and impassioned debate on the draft withdrawal agreement and the outline political declaration on our future relationship with the European Union.
At that point, Dominic Raab must have known that what she was trying to sell was something that he didn't support.
I think it's well on record that at that cabinet meeting, that was where people voiced their opinions. That was the point of no return. That was the point you asked the cabinet to get behind a decision if you didn't agree with it. And remember, Dominic was in an unusual position. He was the only one around that cabinet table who has been asked to go and fly to Brussels and shake hands on this deal. And he's done the authentic right thing, where he's always made his position clear, where he would be. It wasn't just like decided that day.
So the thing that I'm getting confused about is that he is the person who's negotiating this bit of government policy. It was his deal. So why wasn't he selling the deal at that cabinet meeting, or B, having this conversation with the Prime Minister beforehand?
All I can say to you is his position had been consistently clear. Of what he was trying to achieve and where he hoped to land the Prime Minister. He got a long way moving that withdrawal agreement from its 80% to 95%. And they finally reached this point of difference where the Prime Minister wanted to go one way.
What is the point of difference?
Well, the point of difference was the backstop. But also, I think it's worth remembering, as he himself pointed out at that cabinet meeting, that in terms of the future relationship, the future economic relationship, don't forget that he pointed out that it had emerged in the declaration that was being presented to Cabinet that the future basis of the economic relationship would be based on the customs union. That was a position that he neither authored or became aware of, never received a satisfactory explanation as to why it went in, and went against everything in a Conservative manifesto. So as he made clear in his interviews afterwards, that was an untenable position for him, and obviously he made his point clear.
Over it. So we would be signing up to accept rules and laws made by the other EU member states with no regard for the UK circumstances, from economic policy to social policy, and we'd have no way out. No democratic country in history has signed up for that.
So did you know you were going to resign when Dominic Raab resigned?
When you're an appointment, a political appointment like that, you go when your Secretary of State goes. You do not have a choice.
So this controversy centres around the so-called backstop. It effectively keeps Britain in a customs union with the EU if a trade deal is not reached to guarantee a soft Irish border. Theresa May says it is a backup option that will never be used. Nick Dubois was in those negotiations, but he wasn't convinced.
With the backstop, which will almost certainly come into force, because it is inconceivable that we will negotiate a future relationship by December 2020. So the backstop's going to come into play. Once that backstop is in play, it effectively means that we need the EU's permission to actually come out of the backstop situation, which is a UK-wide customs hybrid. It's basically a hybrid customs union and single market.
So your concern is that there's no time limit?
That's absolutely right. There is no, to put it in very simple terms, you cannot see the end of the tunnel.
Why has Theresa May agreed to it then? Do you think the EU could have accepted a time limit for the backstop?
I certainly think we could have made considerably more efforts to go for that. You know, who knows is the reality. You're asking me a hypothetical, but I think there certainly should have been much more effort allowed on it. I think the reality is we should have been able to test the belief that the EU don't want really a backstop. And if that is true, then why were they not willing to put a time limit on it, a reasonable time limit? You know, one alternative proposal, for example, could have been that both parties would have to agree to extend it, otherwise it falls away. But we are now in a situation where effectively we cannot get out of it without the EU's agreement.
It sounds as though the problem in the negotiation was less in Brussels and more at home.
I think the important thing is that we wanted to be governed by something that was in the national interest. That is what everyone wants. And also something that will pass through Parliament. And the acid test will be in 5 or 6 days' time when we see if this particular deal can get through Parliament.
Do you think there's any hope of the Prime Minister getting it through?
Well, I don't think you should ever underestimate the power of Number 10. And I've seen quite a few rebellions in my time collapse. But there's a heck of a mountain for them to overcome in this.
So we are, I mean, it's so high stakes that if she loses the vote, which looks likely, although we don't underestimate Downing Street, Labour could trigger a confidence vote. Mm-hmm. That would be a 50-50 thing. If Theresa May loses that, we then have 14 days to create a new government. Mm-hmm. So presumably the opposition parties could then try to...
Conservatives could do it.
Build something together.
Conservatives could try and form a new government. You only have to win another confidence vote. So it's not a done deal, this general election. But some people have said you could almost stumble into a general election. And I think that's really what I'm saying.
And if you did have a general election, what would the Tories' position be on Brexit?
I look forward to seeing it.
And what are Theresa May's other options?
I think her next options will depend a lot on what likely votes she will have. It's a narrow defeat. I think she's perfectly entitled to try again, and I think there would be a second vote. I hope, to goodness sake, the Conservative Party don't go bonkers and put in 48 letters. I think that would be daft. 48 letters is what it would prompt for a leadership election. I think that would be absolutely crazy. This is far more than about a leader. This is about trying to get the right deal. Some of us think there's still time to do that. But that would depend, I think, on the size of the defeat.
It all sounds quite scary. I mean, Theresa May's got a vote next week. It looks likely that she'll lose it. That could be plunging us towards either a general election or a second referendum. It could be plunging us towards no deal. Do you have any regrets about voting for Brexit?
No, and I also regret the language that's been used about it. You see, when people talk about crashing into no deal, plunging into no deal, I understand it's colourful. I understand it's it sometimes...
How should I have described it?
Well, I think it's just the reality.
Stepping slowly towards no deal?
Well, it is slow, let's be honest. We can probably agree about that. No, look, I think Britain has this huge capacity to both be pragmatic and respond to challenges. We are an amazing nation. Look, I still think that the decision was the right decision. I certainly don't regret the vote. I regret, if you wait, the divisiveness that's grown up around it. It's understandable. But look, this is huge new territory. No one has done this before.
And when we do go out on March 29th next year, probably, will you be back in Spain?
I should be here with everyone else before I go to my holiday home in the summer.
Oh, right.
You're very cheeky, aren't you?
I know, I'm being cheeky. We're coming up for a huge week in UK politics. Keep up with Andrew Sparrow's live blog and all the reporting from our Westminster team on the website and in the paper. Coming up, who suffers when high street jobs go? Now, a quarter of shop space in England and Wales has been lost since the 2008 crash, according to new figures. The Guardian's Poppy Knorr argues that women are losing out the most.
So, Kemi is a woman whose real name isn't Kemi, and I spoke to her for a story in the summer this year. The point at which I spoke to her, she was really kind of trying to hold everything together by a thread, you know. So she lost her job at John Lewis, and Kemi has three small children, one of whom has autism and another who has severe behavioural problems. So she was in the process of looking for a new job in retail. And I remember speaking to her about jobs being lost on the high street and her saying to me, you know, every time I hear about another store closure, I just think, my God, what's going to happen to me? Kemi's completely right to be worried. The stats show that high street shops are closing dramatically. Last year, closures were in the hundreds. This year, they're in the thousands. British high streets are losing 14 shops a day. We know that that's bad for communities. We know it's bad for the economy. But I think something that we don't often think about is how bad it is for women. Retail jobs are great for women because you have shift work, but you know what your shifts are. People can pick up when you're not coming in. It kind of fits around childcare arrangements quite easily. But it was a stable job and it was a well-paid job that you could have a career in and still, you know, meet childcare commitments with. There's a shift to a more kind of convenience-based culture. So you want to be able to sit at home and order a burger there and then. You don't want to have to go out, you know. And there are jobs that are growing. Online retailers are experiencing a big boom. So if you shop online in a place like Amazon, there's a huge warehouse somewhere where someone's stacking and unstacking boxes, who's putting the parcels into vans and driving them around the country, people delivering things to you on mopeds or bikes. Typically, they're the sort of jobs that men do. Going back to someone like Kemi, that type of work it's never going to work for her. Her life is complicated, you know. Her sons have learning difficulties. She's not going to be able to go into work at the drop of a hat like you would be doing if you're working maybe on a 0 hours contract or in a warehouse or as a courier. Often when you talk about the death of the high street, people flag up this thing of, you know, high street stores, they're not making money, they're bad for the economy. But there's this other kind of unseen cost that maybe we're not discussing, which is, what is the cost of hollowing out women's jobs in this way going to be? The people who are going to lose out, they're vulnerable people. They're women with care commitments who have complicated lives. They're people like Kemi.
That's it for today. If you liked Today in Focus, then do us a favour, recommend us to a friend. My thanks to Nick Dubois and Poppy Noor. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Mythili Rao and Brenna Daldorf. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executives were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.